cell phone in my pocket like a talisman. Everyone was eyeing me sideways. I must have startled the customers with my abrupt exit. I did a little courtesy tour around to all my tables just to let people know I had returned to my right mind. I worked through the rest of my shift without descending to the previous level of hell I'd inhabited. Kennedy was singing behind the bar, still happy since Danny had revealed his big secret job hunt to her. I didn't feel like talking about vampire stuff at all, so I just rolled with her good mood. By the time the delivery truck pulled up to the back door, I was borderline normal myself. The lockers fit right in the space I'd cleared for them. I'd already bought padlocks for everyone on the staff, and since Sam wasn't there, I got the pleasure of allotting everyone a locker and explaining that though Sam and I wouldn't go in the lockers unless there was a crisis, we would be keeping a key to each one. Since the ladies had trusted Sam all these years with their purses, they shouldn't have any problem trusting him with a change of clothes or a hairbrush. Everyone was pleased and even a little excited because a change in the workplace can mean a lot. Sam's truck was parked in front of his trailer when my shift was over, so I felt free to take off. Sam and I needed to talk, but not this evening. I stopped by the grocery store on the way home to buy the ingredients for Tara's homecoming meal. I'd left a message on JB's cell phone to tell him I was bringing something over, and just as insurance, I'd left a message on their landline, too. I started cooking in my cool and empty house. I was doing my level best not to think about anything but food preparation. I decided to keep it simple and basic. I made a hamburger and sausage meatloaf, a pasta salad, and a carrot casserole for Tara and JB. The blackberries at the store had been too tempting to resist, and I made a blackberry cobbler. As long as I was cooking, I made duplicates of everything for Dermot and me. Two birds with one stone, I thought proudly. At the little house on Magnolia Street, a smiling JB met me at the door to help me carry in the food. While I went into the kitchen to turn on the stove to warm the meatloaf and casserole a little, the proud father returned to the small, small nursery. I tiptoed in to find Tara and JB staring down at the two cribs holding these amazing tiny beings. I joined them in the admiration gallery. Before I could even ask, Tara said, "Sarah Sookie Durone and Robert Thornton Durone." And I felt the bottom fall out of my heart.
"You named her Sookie?"
"It's her middle name. There's only one Sookie. That's you. We'll call her Sarah. But we wanted her to have your name as part of her identity." I simply refused to cry anymore, but I admit I had to blot my eyes. JB patted my shoulder and went to get the ringing phone before it disturbed the sleepers. Tara and I hugged. The babies continued to snooze, so we sneaked out and eased into the living room. We could hardly find a seat because of the flower arrangements and baby gifts cluttering the room, in fact, the whole house. Tara was very, very happy. So was JB. It permeated their home. I hoped it was catching. "Look what your cousin gave us a couple of weeks ago," Tara said. She lifted a brightly colored box that contained, the print said, a baby gym. The concept confused me, but Tara said it was an arched toy you laid the baby under, and the baby could bat at the bright things with little hands. She showed me the picture.
"Haw," I said. "Claude gave you that?"
I simply couldn't imagine Claude selecting a gift, wrapping it, and bringing it by this house. He genuinely liked babies, though not to eat, as Belenos might suggest. Belenos surely wouldn't really think of... I just couldn't go there. She nodded. "I guess I just send the thank you note to your address? Or pop it through a hole in the air in the woods?"
"Sure, that'll be fine."
"Sookie, is everything okay with you?" Tara said suddenly. "You don't seem quite yourself." The last thing in the world I'd do is intrude on her happiness with my problems, and I could tell from her brain that she really didn't want to hear bad news, but she'd asked anyway, and that counted for a lot.
"I'm good," I said. "I couldn't sleep last night is all."
"Oh, did that big Viking keep you awake?" Tara gave me an elaborately sly look, and we both laughed, though it was hard for me to make it sound genuine. Their supper should be warm by now, and they needed some privacy. They'd been lucky to bring twins home from the hospital this early. I was sure Tara ought to rest. So I said my goodbyes
told Tara I'd stop by in a couple of days to pick up my dishes, and hugged JB on my way out, resolutely blocking out the memory of how he'd looked in his G-string.
Sarah Sookie. Someone was named after me.
I smiled all the way home. Dermot was there when I pulled up, and it was a real delight to know I wouldn't be alone that night. Supper was ready. All we had to do was get it out of the still warm oven. I told Dermot I'd sent the letter Belenos had suggested, and he was so excited that he wanted to go out to the portal then and there to see if there'd been an answer. I persuaded him to wait until the next day, but he was fidgety for a good 20 minutes. Nonetheless, Dermot was the kind of guest you want to have. He complimented the food, and he helped do the dishes. By the time we cleared away, the night outside was humming with the noise of the insects.
"I'm going to finish caulking the attic windows," Dermot said, still humming with energy.
Though before he'd begun work on the attic room, he'd never caulked anything in his life. He'd watched a demonstration online, and he was ready to work.
"You rock, Dermot," I said.
He grinned at me. He was really sticking to the attic renovation, despite what I thought was an increasingly weak chance that Claude would return to claim his bedroom. After he went upstairs, I cracked the kitchen window over the sink so I'd have a little breeze while I scrubbed the sink with some bon ami. A mockingbird had perched outside in a photinia at the corner of the house. The stupid bird was singing to itself loud enough to wake the dead. I wished I had a slingshot. Just as I thought that, I thought I heard a voice outside calling,
"Sookie?"
I went out on the back porch. Sure enough, Bill was waiting in the backyard.
"I can smell the ferry from here," he said. "I know I can't come in. Can you step out?"
"Hold on a minute." I rinsed out the sink, dried my hands on the dish towel, and shut the window to keep in the air conditioning. Then, hoping my hair still looked decent, I went outside. Bill had been having some vampire down time. He was standing silent in the darkness, lost in his thoughts. When he heard me approach, he stepped out into the bright security light, looking both intent and focused. It was easy to see that Bill had a list of things to tell me.
"I'll start with the lesser things first," he said, rather stiffly. "I don't know if you've spared a moment to wonder about my efforts to find out who killed the young woman, but I assure you I'm trying to find out. She died while I was patrolling, and I won't be easy until I understand why it happened."
Taken aback, I could only nod slightly.
"I don't know why you thought I... Oh, Eric. Well, never mind. Please tell me what you've discovered. Would you like to sit?"
We both sat in the lawn chairs.
"Heidi and I went over Eric's backyard with great attention," Bill said. "You know it slopes down to a brick wall, the outer perimeter of the gated community."
"Right."
I hadn't spent more than 10 minutes total in Eric's backyard, but I knew its contours.
"There's a gate in the brick wall."
"Yes, for the yard crew."
Bill said this like having a yard crew was an exotic indulgence, like having a bunch of peacocks.
"It's easier for the yard crew to gather all the yard debris and carry it out the back, rather than go uphill to the curb."
His tone made it plain what he thought of people who like to have a job made easier for them.
"It isn't kept locked?"
I was startled at the idea that it might have been swinging open.
"Normally, yes. And normally, Mustafa is responsible for unlocking it for the yard crew on the day they're expected, and he's also responsible for locking it after they're done, but the lock was missing."
"A werewolf or vampire could have snapped it," I said, "so Mustafa's not necessarily guilty of opening the gate anyway."
"He'd done something wrong, though. You don't vanish unless you've done something wrong. What did you smell? Anything?"
"Even Heidi could not say for certain who'd been there," Bill said. "Many humans, sweaty humans, the yard workers, a dash of fairy, but that could have been a very faint trace of the vial around the girl's neck, and a stronger trace of Tui. That could have been from the girl herself."
He leaned back and looked up into the night sky, the only sky he'd seen in more than 130 years.
"What do you think happened?"
I asked him after we'd been quiet for a few calm moments. I'd been looking up, along with Bill. Though Bonton was close, it only cast a faint glow upward, especially this late. I could see the stars, vast and cold and distant. I shivered.
Look, Suki, he said, and held out something small. I took it and held it up to my nose to try to make it out in the patchy light.
It's true, then, I said.
It was a rubber stopper, the kind that would close a small vial.
Where did you find it?
In the living room. It rolled under the dining table and landed right by a chair leg. I think the woman, Kim, took out the stopper when she knew she was going to see Eric face to face, he said. She dropped it while she drank the blood. She tucked the vial down into her bra in case the lingering scent would attract him further, and when I found her on the lawn, I could smell that she was two-natured. That would have added to her allure.
The dad's two-natured, aware, I think. The Rose showed up here at my house yesterday with a reporter to try to make something quotable happen.
Bill wanted to hear all about it.
You have the reporter's card?
He asked when I'd finished. I went into the house and found it on the kitchen counter. Now that I took a moment to look at it, I discovered that Harp Powell was based in Terre Sauvage, a small town that lay north of the interstate between Bonton and Shreveport.
Huh,
I said, handing it to Bill. I assumed he was based in Shreveport or Baton Rouge or Monroe. Bill said,
I met this man at Fantasia. He's been published by a small regional press. He's written several books.
Bill sounded quite respectful. He had great admiration for the written word.
What was he doing at Fantasia?
I asked, diverted.
He interviewed me and Maxwell Lee, since we're both native Louisianans. He was hoping to do a collection of Louisiana vampires' histories. He wanted to listen to our recollections of the times we grew up in, the historical events we'd witnessed. He thought that would be interesting.
So, a ripoff of Christina Sobol? I tried not to sound sarcastic. Sobol's Dead History 1 had been on all the bestseller lists a couple of years before. Amazon had sent me a notice to tell me that Dead History 2 would be out in a month. These books, as you may have guessed, were vampires' reminiscences about the times they'd lived in. Harp Powell was doing a regional twist on a national bestseller.
Bill nodded. I'm trying to remember if he asked questions about Eric. I believe that he wanted Eric's phone number in case he needed to get in touch with him. I didn't give it to him, of course, but he could have discovered Eric's address online.
Bill was one of the computer-savvy vampires.
Okay, so he could have found out where Eric lives, but why would a writer have any reason to send Kim Rowe into the house or to murder her afterward?
I don't have the slightest idea, Bill said, but we can surely go ask him. I'm trying to think of some other avenue of investigation, one that doesn't lead back to someone in Eric's house.
I'm not saying that Harp Powell isn't fishy, showing up with Kim's parents, but it seems more likely that he's just riding the publicity train. To me, it appears a lot more likely that Mustafa let Kim row in so she could find Eric and offer herself. I just don't know why. Why did someone prep her and send her in to do that? Why did they get Mustafa to delay my arrival? I guess so that she'd have time to hook Eric. But then, why have me come in? Mustafa could have told me that the meeting had been canceled or that I should go to Fantasia instead. 100 different things.
His role in this is a mystery,
Bill said, shrugging.
She was obviously bait for Eric, designed to arouse his lust.
Bill looked at me and blinked.
His bloodlust,
he added hastily.
But she must have had some piece of information, if only the name of who hired her to do this. When you argued with Eric and he sent the girl away, someone went after her and seized her head and twisted.
Bill made a very graphic motion with his hands, no stranger to the seizing and twisting he. Disregarding why she was killed, I said, why was she sent there in the first place? Getting me mad at Eric doesn't seem to be much of a reason. Bill looked down at his hands.
There are a couple of theories that fit the few facts we're sure of, he said slowly, and these theories are what I'll tell Eric. The first is that Eric himself, or Pam, or Mustafa, followed the Roe woman out of the house and killed her out of sheer anger at the trouble she'd caused. Perhaps, if the killer was Eric, he wanted to erase the memory of the offense he'd committed against you.
I stiffened. This was nothing I hadn't thought of myself, but hearing it out loud made it seem more likely.
The other theory, well, that's more complex.
Bill shifted his gaze to the dark woods.
Since Ware let the girl in, I have to assume she was part of some Ware plot. I should suspect Alcide, since he's the pack leader.
but I don't believe that Alcide would plan such a convoluted method of discrediting Eric. Alcide's a relatively straightforward man, and an intelligent one, at least in some respects. Evidently, women are a huge blind spot for him.
Bill raised an eyebrow. That was a pretty good evaluation of Alcide's character.
But what Ware would do this without Alcide's say-so, I said.
Mustafa is a lone wolf.
Bill shrugged. Obvious.
But Mustafa didn't bring Kim Rowe to the house, I argued. You said the scent trail didn't tell you that.
He must have known she was coming. Suki, I know you like the man in some measure, but he knew about this in advance. Maybe he didn't know why she was coming to the house, but he knew if he let her in unchallenged, everyone in the house would assume she'd been invited. And he knew the girl wasn't there to scrub toilets or sing for the company. She was there to get Eric to drink from her. Since Mustafa was the one who called you and told you to come later, his purpose must have been to make sure you were not there to prevent Eric from being interested in her.
But the only result was that I got mad at Eric. Bill, who cares that much about my love life?
Bill gave me a very direct look, and I could feel myself turning red. But instead of making a personal reference, Bill said,
You had a visitor last night who cares very deeply.
I tried not to flinch too obviously. You know she came to the house?
We all know about her presence in Area 5, Suki. All of us who are sworn to Eric. It's hard to cover up the visit of a queen, especially one as well-known as Freyda. It's even harder to remain ignorant of exactly where she is. She went to the casino to confer with Felipe directly after she left your house, and Felipe summoned Eric there. He took Thalia with him, not Pam. Thalia said it was a very tense meeting.
That explained the delay in Eric's calling me, but it didn't make me feel any better. What makes Freyda so well known?
I bypassed all the obvious conversational openings that Bill's little speech presented to lock in on what was most interesting to me. I was all too aware that Bill could see how desperate I was to know more about her, and I just didn't care. Bill kindly looked down at his hands as he told me,
She's beautiful, of course. Ambitious. Young. She's not content to sit on her throne and let things hum along. By the way, she had to fight for that throne. She killed a predecessor, and he didn't make it easy. Freyda has worked hard to extend the business dealings of Oklahoma. The only thing slowing her progress is her lack of a strong and loyal second. If she acquires the strong vampire she needs to serve as her right hand, she'll always have to watch her back against that vampire's ambition. If she marries this right hand, he can't succeed her. His loyalty will be assured, because his fate is bound to hers.
I pondered this for a few minutes, while Bill sat in silence. Vampires are great at that. I caught his eyes on my face. I got the impression that Bill felt sorry for me. A worm of panic twisted in my stomach. Freda's strong, active, and determined, I said, like Eric. And you say she needs a good fighter, a good second, like Eric.
Yes, like Eric, he said deliberately. Freyda would be a great match for him. Practically speaking, he'd escape from the political situation created by his murder of Victor. The king's going to have to do something to Eric. Felipe really can't afford to be perceived as ignoring Victor's death.
Why not?
He looked at me blankly.
Felipe let Victor get away with whatever the hell Victor wanted to do, I said. Why shouldn't he be perceived that way?
He doesn't want to lose the loyalty of the vampires who serve him,
Bill said.
That's ridiculous!
I thought steam would come out of my ears.
You can't have it all different ways!
But he'll try. I don't think you're really angry about Felipe. You're really angry about the hard practicality of Eric marrying Freyda.
I winced, but Bill continued ruthlessly.
You have to admit that her character is much like Eric's, and that they'd make a good team.
Eric's my team, I said. He loves me. He wants to stay here.
I realized that I was, so to speak, batting with another hand now. I had been just as sure the night before that Eric would leave, that he loved power more than he loved me.
But, Suki, you must see, staying might be the death of him.
I could read a mixture of pity and tough love in Bill's attitude. Bill, are you sure you're able to judge that?
I hope that I have your best interests in my heart, Suki.
He paused, as if considering whether he should go on.
I know you'll suspect everything I say about this situation, because I love you, and I don't love Eric. But truly, I want your happiness, above almost everything else.
Almost everything else. I found myself wondering what came ahead of that, his own survival. I heard the screen door bang, and Dermot hurried out to his car.
Got to get to the club, he called.
Drive careful, I called back. He was gone before I could say anything more. I turned back to Bill, who was staring at the spot where Dermot had stood, a wistful expression on his face. No wonder Dermot had hurried. He'd surely known a vampire was in the backyard and that his scent would be attractive.
Let's get back to the Kim Rowe issue, I said, to get Bill's attention. What can I do to help you find out who killed her?
The first person we'd want to talk to is Mustafa, and he's vanished. Tell me exactly what he said when he was here.
Which time? When he was here before the night of the party, or when he was here after the party?
Tell me about both visits.
I related the first conversation to Bill, though there was surprisingly little to tell. Mustafa had been here. He'd relayed Pam's warning, which I hadn't understood until I'd met Freda. He'd warned me about Janilyn. The second time he was here, he'd been worried about Warren.
You've told Eric this? He asked.
I snorted. We're not exactly having lengthy heart-to-hearts these days. My conversation with Freda was longer than any talk I've had with Eric.
Wisely, Bill didn't comment. He recapped. So, Mustafa comes to your house, though he's been missing ever since the girl died. He tells you that he wants to talk to Alcide, but he's afraid to call him or approach him directly, since Janilyn might be around to intercept him.
I thought that was a fair summary.
Yes, and I've passed that message along to Alcide, I said. Plus, what's most important to Mustafa, his friend Warren is missing. I think someone abducted Warren and they're holding him in return for Mustafa's good behavior.
Then finding Warren would be a good thing, Bill said, and I winced when I heard his voice. I'd screwed up.
I get that it was dumb for me not to have mentioned this first of all, I said. I'm sorry.
Tell me about this Warren.
You haven't ever seen him?
Bill shrugged.
No, why would I?
He's a shooter. He was stationed outside Fantasia the night we killed Victor.
So that was Warren. Skinny little guy, big eyes, long hair.
Sounds right.
What are he and Mustafa to each other?
It was my turn to shrug.
I have no idea. They were in prison together, I think.
Mustafa was in prison?
I nodded. Yeah, his real name is Keyshawn Johnson. I got that out of his head.
Bill looked puzzled.
But do you remember the vampire who decapitated Waybert at the beginning of the brawl at Sophie Anne's monastery?
I'll never forget that. Then, dreadlocks?
His name was Roshan.
We were just swapping expressions. It was my turn to do puzzled.
No, I don't recollect that at all. Oh, wait, yeah, Andre told me his name.
You don't think it's an interesting coincidence? Roshan and Keyshawn, both black, both supernaturals.
But one's a werewolf and the other was a vampire. Roshan could have been born hundreds of years ago. I guess they could be related.
I think that's just possible.
Bill was giving me a long-suffering look.
The database, I suggested, and he pulled a little bunch of keys from his pocket. There was a black rectangle attached to the key ring.
I have it right here, he said,
and I was amazed all over again at Bill's plunge into the modern world.
And that would be a what? I asked.
This is a jump drive?
Bill looked quizzical.
Oh, sure.
I'd had enough of feeling dumb for the evening. We went inside so Bill could use my computer. Bill carried over a chair for me and then took a seat in the rolling chair directly in front of the screen. He inserted the little stick into a slot I hadn't even realized was on the side of my computer. After a couple of minutes, he had the vampire directory on the screen.
Wow.
I looked at the opening, some very dramatic graphics. A pair of gothic gates hung closed, a giant lock on them. The background music was dark and atmospheric. I hadn't paid any attention when I'd used a stolen copy of the database before because I'd been so conscious of my guilt. Now I could appreciate the graveyard humor in Bill's presentation.
A written introduction appeared, superimposed on the gates in many different languages. After you selected the language you wanted, a solemn voice read the introduction out loud. Bill skipped through all that. He touched a few keys, and the Gothic gates creaked open to show all our options. As Bill explained, you could sort the vampires in different ways. You could look for vampires in Yugoslavia, for example, or you could look for female vampires in the St. Louis area, or all vampires more than 1,000 years old in Myanmar.
I can't believe you did all this, I said admiringly. It's so cool.
It was a lot of work, he said absently, and I had a lot of help.
How many languages is it available in?
So far, 30.
This must have made money hand over fist, Bill. I hope you got some of it yourself.
I hoped it wasn't pouring into the bank account of Felipe de Castro, who so didn't deserve it. I've made some change from it, Bill said, smiling.
That was a good expression to see on Bill's face. He didn't wear it often enough. In a jiffy, he called up the entry for Rashan. The vampire had been about 30 at the time of his human death, but he'd been a vampire for maybe 100 years at the time of his second death. Rashan's background was hazy, but he'd first been noticed in Haiti, Bill's sources had told him. The dreadlocked Rashan had long been a cult figure in the black supernatural community. He had been the cool and deadly black vampire, hired by kings, gangsters, and political figures as a fighter.
Well, I said, maybe Mustafa's, Kishan's, parents were into supernatural African culture. After prison, maybe he became a blade clone because he wanted a more current model.
Everybody needs a hero, Bill agreed, and I opened my mouth to ask him who his had been, Robert E. Lee. What are you two doing?
Eric asked, and I jumped and gave a little yip of surprise. Even Bill twitched. It's only polite to let me know you're coming into my house, I said, because he'd really scared me and I was angry in consequence.
It's only polite,
Eric said mockingly, imitating my voice in a very irritating way.
I think it's only polite that my wife should let me know when she's entertaining a male visitor, furthermore, one that has shared her bed.
I took a deep breath, hoping it would help me calm down. You're acting like an asshole, I said, so maybe the deep breath hadn't helped so very much. I have never cheated on you, and I have trusted you never to cheat on me. Maybe I should rethink that, since you don't seem to have much faith in me.
Eric looked taken aback. I have never fucked another woman since I took you to wife, he said haughtily.
I couldn't help but realize that left a lot of territory uncovered, but now was not the time to ask detailed questions. Bill was sitting like a statue. I spared a second to appreciate his predicament. Eric was so plainly in a very bad mood, anything Bill said was going to be taken in evidence against him. A diversion was in order, though I felt a flash of resentment that I had to defuse the situation.
Why are you so mad anyway? I said. Something go wrong at Fantasia?
Eric's face relaxed just a fraction.
Nothing is right, he said. Felipe and his companions are still in town. He may still bring charges against me for killing Victor. At the same time, you can tell he's delighted we killed Victor. He and Freda have just had a long talk in private. Mustafa is still missing. The police have been by Fantasia to question me again. They wanted me to permit cadaver dogs to go over my property. I had to say yes, but it makes me furious. How stupid would I be to bury someone on my own property? They've searched the house again. T-Rex and his women came into the bar tonight, and he acted as though he were my best friend. The women used drugs in the bathroom. Thalia rousted them a little too energetically and broke Cherie's nose. I'll have to pay for her hospital visit, though she did promise not to relate what had happened in return for our not telling the police she's a drug user.
My goodness, I said gently. And then you walk in your girlfriend's house to find her looking at a computer screen with another man. You have had a terrible night, poor fella.
Bill raised an eyebrow to let me know I was troweling it on too thick. I ignored him.
If I'd seen you around, or had a conversation with you that lasted longer than 30 seconds, I'd have told you that Mustafa had come by here, I said in a sweet voice, and I'd have told you what he said.
Tell me now, Eric said in a much more neutral voice, if you please.
Okay, he'd made an effort. So, once again, I related the account of Mustafa's visit, his warning about Janelin, and his concern for Warren's safety.
So Bill and Heidi need to scent this Janilyn, and then we'll know if she was the one who led the girl to my house, who sent her up to Mustafa. We'll know why he was involved with this plan if we can find him, or his friend Warren, and they'll tell us what we can do to get them out of the picture.
Suki, would Sam call this woman if you asked him to do so?
My mouth fell open. That would be terrible of me, to ask him to bring her in, to betray her. I won't do it.
But you can see that would be the best for all of us,
Eric said. Bill or Heidi goes up to her, shakes her hand, then they will have her scent, and we'll know. Sam doesn't need to do anything beyond that. We'll take care of everything else.
What would that everything else be?
What do you think?
Bill asked impatiently.
She has information we need to learn, and she seems to be a key part of the plot to implicate Eric in a murder. This woman is a murderer herself, most likely. We need to make her talk.
The same way the Wares made you talk in Mississippi, Bill? I snapped.
Why do you care if something happens to the bitch?
Eric said, his blonde eyebrows rising in query. I don't, I said instantly. I can't stand her.
Then what's your issue?
And I had no answer.
It's because we were talking about involving Sam, Bill told Eric. That's the stumbling block.
Suddenly, they were on the same side, and that side was not mine.
You're sweet on him?
Eric said. He couldn't have been more surprised if I'd had a crush on Terry's Catahoula. He's my boss, I said. We've been friends for years. Of course I'm fond of him, and he's nuts about that furry bitch for whatever reason, so that's my issue, as you put it.
Hmm.
Eric said, his eyes examining my face with a sharp intensity. I didn't like it when he sounded thoughtful.
Then I'll have to call Alcide and make the request for Janilyn's scent official.
Did I do as they requested, which would in some way be a betrayal of Sam? Or did I let Eric call Alcide, which would officially involve the Longtooth Pack? You couldn't call a packmaster unofficially, but I couldn't lie to Sam. My back stiffened. All right, I said. Call Alcide. Eric pulled out his cell phone, giving me a very grim look as he did so. I could see a war starting, another war, more deaths, more loss. Wait, I said. I'll talk to Sam. I'll go into town to talk to him, right now. I didn't even know if Sam was home, but I walked out of the house, and neither vampire tried to stop me. I'd never left two vampires alone in the house before. And I could only hope it would be intact when I returned. Chapter 10. When I began driving back into town, I realized how tired I was. I thought very seriously about turning back, but when I contemplated facing Bill and Eric again, I kept driving north. That was how I came to see Belenos and our hooligans waitress bounding across the road after a deer. I braked desperately, and my car slid sideways. I knew I'd end up in the ditch. I shrieked as the car slewed, and the woods rushed up to meet me. Then, abruptly, my car's motion stopped, not by hitting anything, but by being nose down in the steep ditch. The headlights lit up the weeds, still whipping, bugs flying up from the impact. I turned off the engine and sat, gasping. My poor car was nose down at a steep angle. The rain had had 24 hours to soak into the previously parched soil, so the ditch was fairly dry, which was a real blessing. Belenos and the blonde appeared, working their way around the car to get to my door. Belenos was carrying a spear, and his companion appeared to have two curved, bladed weapons of some kind. Not exactly swords, really long knives, as thin at the point as needles. I tried to open the door, but my muscles wouldn't obey my command. I realized I was crying. I had a sharp flash of memory, Claudine waking me when I fell asleep at the wheel on the same road. Belenos's lithe body moved across the headlights, and then he was by my door and wrenching it open.
Sister,
he said, and he turned to his companion.
Cut this strap, gift.
A knife passed right by my face in the next second, and the seatbelt was severed. Oh, damn. Evidently, they didn't understand buckles. Gift bent down, and in the next instant, I was out of the car, and she was carrying me away.
We didn't mean to frighten you, she murmured. I'm sorry, my sister.
She laid me down as easily as if I'd been an infant,
and she and Bellino squatted by me. I concluded, with no great certainty, that they weren't going to kill and eat me. When I could speak, I said,
"What were you out here doing?"
"Hunting," Bellino said, as if he suspected my head were addled. "You saw the deer?"
"Yes. Do you realize you're not on my land anymore?"
My voice was very unsteady, but there was nothing I could do about it.
"I see no fence, no boundaries. Freedom is good," he said.
And the blonde nodded enthusiastically.
"It's so good to run," she said. "It's so good to be out of a human building." The thing was, they seemed so happy.
Though I knew absolutely I should read them the riot act, I found myself feeling not only profoundly sorry for the two Fae, but frightened of and for them. This was a very uncomfortable mix of emotions.
"I'm real glad you're having a good time,"
I wheezed. They both beamed at me.
"How did you come to be named Gift?"
I just couldn't think of anything else to say.
"It's Elfifu," she said, smiling. "Elf Gift. But Gift is easier for human mouths."
Speaking of mouths, Elf Yivu's teeth were not as ferocious as Bellinos's. In fact, they were quite small, but since she was leaning over me, I could see longer, sharper, thinner teeth folded against the roof of her mouth. Fangs. Not vampire fangs, but snake fangs.
Jesus Christ, Shepherd of Judea.
Coupled with the pupilless eyes, she was really scary.
"Is this the way you do in Faerie?"
I asked weakly.
"Hunt in the woods?"
They both smiled.
"Oh yes, no fences or boundaries there," Alf Yavu said longingly. "Though the woods are not as deep as they once were." "I don't want to chide you,"
I said, wondering if I could sit up. They both stared at me, their eyes unreadable, their heads canted at inhuman angles.
"But regular people really shouldn't see you without your human disguises. And even if you could make other people perceive you as human, regular human couples don't chase deer in the middle of the night with sharp weapons."
"Even around Bontemps, where hunting is practically a religion."
"You see us as we really are," Bellino said.
I could tell he hadn't known that before. Maybe I'd given away a powerful bit of knowledge by revealing that.
"Yeah. You have powerful magic," Gift said respectfully. "That makes you our sister. When you first came to Hooligans, we weren't sure about you. Are you on our side?"
Bellinos's hand shot across me, and he gripped Alf Yifu's shoulder. Their eyes met. In the weird light and shadows cast by the headlights, her eyes looked just as black as his.
"I don't know what side that is,"
I said, to break the moment up. It seemed to work, because she laughed and slid an arm underneath me, and I sat up.
"You're not hurt," she said. "Dermot will be pleased. He loves you."
Bellinos put an arm around me too, so our little trio was suddenly positioned in an uncomfortably intimate little scene there on the deserted road. Bellinos's teeth were awfully close to my flesh. Sure, I was used to Eric biting, but he didn't rip off flesh and eat it.
"You're shaking, sister," Alf Yavu observed. "You can't be cold on a hot night like tonight. Is it the shock of your little accident?"
"You can't be frightened of us,"
Bellino sounded mocking.
"You turkey," I said. "Of course I'm scared of you. If you'd spent a while with Lachlan and Neve, you'd be scared too." "We're not like them," Alf Yavu said in a much more subdued voice. "And we're sorry, sister. There are quite a few of us who endured their attentions. Not all live to tell others about it. You're very fortunate."
"Did you have the magic then?"
Bellinos asked. This was the second time the elf had referred to my having magic. I was very curious to know why he said that, but at the same time, I hated to expose my total ignorance.
"Could I drive you two back to Monroe?"
I asked, staving off Bellinos's question.
"I couldn't bear to be shut up in an iron box," Gift said. "We'll run. May we come to hunt on your land tomorrow night?"
"How many of you?" I thought I should err on the side of caution here. They helped me to my feet, consulting with each other silently as they did so.
"Four of us,"
Bellino said, trying not to sound as if he were asking me.
That would be okay, I said, long as you let me explain where the boundaries are.
I got simultaneous kisses on both sides of my face. Then the two fae leaped down in the ditch, bent over to get a grip below the hood of my car, and pushed. The car was back up on the road in seconds. Aside from the severed seatbelt, it didn't seem to be much the worse for the experience. Dirty, of course, and the front fender was a little dented. Gift waved at me cheerfully as I took my place behind the wheel, and then the two were off, heading east toward Monroe, at least while I could see them. My car started up, thank God, and I turned around at the next driveway and headed home. My excursion was over. I was completely jangled. As I pulled up, I could tell the vampires were still there. When I glanced at my car clock, I saw that only 20 minutes had passed since I'd left. Suddenly, I began shivering all over when I thought of the incident, the panicked deer, the swift and deadly pursuit, the fae's overly loving solicitousness. I turned off the car and got out slowly. I was going to be stiff all over the next morning. I just knew it. Of course, Bill and Eric had heard me return, but neither of them came rushing out to see how I was. I reminded myself they didn't have any idea something had happened to me. I stepped out of the car and thought I'd go flat on my face. I was having some kind of reaction to the whole bizarre incident, and I couldn't stop replaying the running figures in my mind. They'd looked so alien, so very, very not human. And now I knew that someone suspected I had some powerful fae magic. If the fae suspected it was contained in an item, I didn't like my chances of keeping it, or of keeping my life, for that matter. Any soup would want such a thing, especially the hodgepodge of fae trapped at Hooligan's. They were yearning for the homeland of fairy, no matter how they'd come to be trapped in our world. Any power they could acquire would be more than they had now, and if they had the Cluvial Door, they could wish the doors of fairy open to them again.
"Sookie,"
Eric said.
"Lover, what's happened to you? Are you hurt? Sookie?"
Bill's voice, equally urgent. I could only stand staring straight ahead, thinking hard about what would happen if the rogue fae opened the portals to fairy. What if humans could walk into that other country? What if all fae could come and go as they pleased? Would they accept that state of affairs, or would there be another war?
"I had a wreck,"
I said, belatedly realizing that Eric had picked me up and was carrying me inside.
"I never got to Sam's. I had a wreck."
"That's all right, Sookie," Eric said. "Don't worry about going to Sam's. That can wait. We can make some other arrangement." "At least I'm not smelling any blood," he said to Bill. "Did you hit your head?" Bill asked. I could feel fingers working through my hair, then those fingers stilled. "You reek of fairy."
I could see the hunger rising in his face. I glanced at Eric, whose mouth was compressed tight as a mousetrap. I was willing to bet his fangs had popped out. The entrancing eau de fae, it acted on vampires like catnip on cats.
"You guys need to leave," I said. "Out you go before you both use me as a chewy toy."
"But Sookie," Eric protested. "I want to stay with you and make love to you at length."
You couldn't get any more frank than that.
"I appreciate the enthusiasm, but with me smelling like a fairy, I'm afraid you might get a little carried away."
"Oh no, my lover," he protested.
"Please, Eric, some self-control. You and Bill need to get."
It was my mention of self-control that did it. Neither of them would admit to a failure of the trait vampires prized so highly. Eric went to stand at the edge of the woods. He said,
"While you were gone, Thalia called me. I'd sent her to talk to the human, Colton, at his job. When she got there, they reported he hadn't come in for work. Thalia went to his trailer. A fight had taken place inside. There was a small amount of blood. Colton was gone. I think Felipe has found him."
While Eric was still maintaining deniability over the death of Victor, Colton had actually been in Fantasia the night Victor had died. He knew the truth, and he was human, and, therefore, could be made to talk. Bill took a step toward me.
"It'll be okay,"
he said reassuringly, and even though he was a vampire, I could tell that he simply wanted to be closer.
Okay, we'll talk about that tomorrow, I said hastily.
At this point, I was sure that all I could do for Colton was pray for him. There was certainly no way to find him tonight. Very reluctantly, and with many goodbyes and hopeful requests that they be called if I felt unwell during what remained of the night, Eric and Bill went their separate ways. After I'd locked the doors, I took a hot shower. I could already feel myself beginning to stiffen up. I had to work the next day, and I couldn't afford to hobble. At least one small mystery was solved. I assumed that the absence of Belenos and his friend Alfyavu was the crisis that had called my great-uncle back to Hooligans in such a tear. While I was sorry for his tough night, I wasn't so sorry that I planned to wait up for him. I crawled into bed. I was briefly conscious of the profound gratitude I felt that this sucky day was finally, finally over. And then I was out. I staggered out of my bedroom at 9 the next day. I wasn't as sore as I'd feared, which was a pleasant discovery. No one stirred in my house. I carefully checked with my other sense, the telepathy that could locate any creature thinking in the house. No one was sleeping here either. What did I need to do today? I made a little list after I'd had my coffee and a Pop-Tart. I needed to go to the grocery store because I'd promised Jason I'd make him a sweet potato casserole to serve to Michelle and her mom tonight. It wasn't exactly sweet potato season, but he texted me to ask me specially, and Jason didn't ask me for much these days. As long as I had to go to the store to get the ingredients, I reminded myself to check with Tara. I could pick up anything she wanted from the grocery store at the same time. Then I needed to think of a way to see Janilyn, so Bill and Heidi could sniff her. Since Eric's vampire Palomino was visiting Hair of the Dog, if worst came to worst, maybe I could get Palomino to lift something of Janilyn's. Asking Janilyn if she'd stand still for a minute and let the vamp trackers check her out was never a serious option. I could imagine all too clearly how she'd react to such a proposal. And Bill was considering visiting Hart Powell to talk about the dead girl. I didn't know if we would be able to find time tonight. I thought of Kim's parents and shuddered. As unpleasant as her life sounded, meeting Oscar and Georgine just once made her bad choices more understandable. While I was thinking about the evening's possibilities, I recalled that the Fae wanted hunting permission again for tonight. I tried not to imagine the consequences if they all fanned out into the Louisiana countryside to find entertainment. I remembered the unease I'd felt last night when Alfyavu and Belenos had referred to my magic. Without knowing I was going to do it, I found myself in my bedroom, looking into my dressing table drawer to check that the cluvial door was safe and still camouflaged as a powder compact. Of course, it was. I let out a deep breath of relief. When I looked into the mirror, I looked scared. So I thought of something else to worry about. Warren was missing, Emmanuel was in California and presumably safe, but where was Colton, the other human who'd been in Fantasia that bloody night? We had to assume that Felipe had him stashed somewhere. Colton wasn't aware, he had no Fae blood, and he didn't owe allegiance to any vampire. He was just an employee at a vampire-owned enterprise. No one would be looking for him unless I called the police. Would that do any good? Would Colton thank me for drawing his abduction to the attention of the police? I couldn't decide. Time to give myself a good shake and get into my Merlot's outfit. In this weather, I didn't mind wearing the shorts. I shaved my legs just to be sure they were smooth, admired their brownness, and moisturized lavishly. By the time I applied my makeup, collected my grocery list, and grabbed my cell phone off the charger, it was time to go. On my way to town, I called Tara, who said she didn't need anything. JV's mom had gone to the store for them that morning. She sounded tired, and I could hear one of the babies crying in the background. I was able to draw a line through one item. Since my own grocery list was so short, I stopped at the old Piggly Wiggly. I could get in and out of it faster than Walmart. Though I saw Maxine Fortenberry and had to pass the time of day with her, I still emerged from the store with only one bag and plenty of time to spare. Feeling very efficient, I was tying on my apron 15 minutes early. Sam was behind the bar talking to Hoyt Fortenberry, who was taking an early lunch hour. I stopped to visit for a second, told Hoyt I'd seen his mom, asked him how the wedding plans were going, he rolled his eyes, and gave Sam a pat on the back by way of apology for my emotional excesses over the telephone the day before. He smiled back at me and continued poking at Hoyt about the potholes on the street in front of the bar. I stowed my purse in my shiny new locker. I wore the key to it on a chain around my neck. The other waitresses were delighted to have real lockers, and from the stuffed bags they carried in, I was sure the lockers were already full. Everyone wanted to keep a change of clothes, an extra umbrella, some makeup, a hairbrush. Even Derek and Antoine seemed pleased with the new system. As I passed Sam's office, I saw the coat rack inside, and on it was a jacket, a bright red jacket. Janelin's. Before I could think about what I was doing, I stepped into Sam's office, stole the jacket, and retreated to stuff it inside my locker. I'd found a quick and easy solution to the problem of getting Janelin sent to the noses of Bill and Heidi. I even persuaded myself that Sam wouldn't mind if I were to tell him, but I didn't test that idea by asking permission to take the jacket. I'm not used to feeling underhanded, and I have to confess that for an hour or two, I kept away from Sam. That was unexpectedly easy, since the bar was really busy. The Association of Local Insurance Agents came in for their monthly lunch together, and since it was so hot, they were all mighty thirsty. The EMT team on duty parked the ambulance outside and ordered their food. Jason and his road crew came in, and so did a bunch of nurses from the blood bank truck parked on the town square today. Though I was working hard, the idea of bags of blood reminded me of Eric. Like all roads leading to Rome, all my thoughts seemed to come back to the certain prospect of misery to come. As I stood staring into the kitchen, waiting for a basket of French fried pickles for the insurance agents, my heart felt as if it were beating way too fast. I revisited the single disturbing scenario over and over. Eric would choose her. He would leave me. What weighed on me with incredible heaviness was the idea of using the love gift given by Fenton to my grandmother, the Cluvial Door. If I understood its properties correctly, a wish on behalf of someone I loved would surely be granted. This fairy object, which Amelia had heard was no longer made in the Fey world, might come with a penalty for its use. I had no idea if there would be a price to pay, much less how steep that price would be. But if I used it to keep Eric...
Sookie,
Antoine said, sounding anxious.
Hey girl, you hearing me? Here's your pickles, for the third time.
Thanks, I said, picking up the red plastic basket and hurrying to the table. I smiled all around, put the basket neatly in the middle, and checked to see if anyone needed a drink refill. They all did, so I went to get the pitcher of sweet tea while taking one glass with me to refill with Coke. Then Jason asked for more mayonnaise for his hamburger, and Jane Boathouse wanted a bowl of pretzels to go with her lunch, but light. By the time the noon crowd thinned out, I was feeling a little more normal. I reminded Jason I was making his sweet potato casserole and that he should come by tonight to pick it up.
Sook, thanks, he said with his charming smile. Her mom is gonna love it, and so will Michelle. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. I can grill meat, but I ain't no kitchen chef.
I worked the rest of the shift on automatic. I had a little conversation with Sam about whether to change insurance companies for the bar or whether Sam should insure his trailer separately. The State Farm agent had spoken to Sam at lunchtime. Finally, it was time to go, but I had to fiddle around until the storage room was empty and I could open the locker to remove the borrowed jacket. Borrowed sounded much better than stolen. I'd found an empty Walmart bag and I stuffed the jacket into it, though my hands were clumsy because I was trying to hurry. Just as I tied the plastic handles together and opened the back door, I saw Sam go into his office. But he didn't come out again to yell, "Where's my honey's jacket?" I drove home and unloaded the bag of groceries and the bag containing Janelin's jacket. I felt as if I'd lifted the collection plate from the church. I took off my uniform and put on some denim shorts and a camo tank top Jason had given me for my birthday the year before. I left a message on Bill's answering machine before I began cooking. I put a big pot of water on the stove so it could reach the boiling point. As I peeled the sweet potatoes and cut them into chunks for cooking, I turned on the radio. It provided background noise, at least until the Shreveport news came on. In the wake of Kim Rowe's murder, anti-vamp sentiment was escalating. Someone had thrown a bucket of white paint across the facade of Fantasia. There was nothing I could do about that, so I pushed that worry to the back of my mind. The vamps could more than take care of themselves, unless things got much, much worse. After I'd eased the sweet potatoes into the boiling water and turned the heat down to simmer, I checked my email.
Tara had sent some pictures of the babies. Cute. I'd gotten a chain letter from Maxine, which I deleted without reading, and I'd gotten a message from Michelle. She had a short list of 3 wedding dates she and Jason were considering, and she wanted to know if all 3 were clear for me. I smiled, looked at my empty calendar, and had just sent my reply when I heard a car pull up. My schedule for the evening was full, so I wasn't very pleased at having an uninvited guest. I was even more astonished when I looked out the living room window to see that my caller was Donald Calloway, Brenda Hesterman's partner in Splendide. I'd wondered if I'd hear from them after Sam told me about the break-in, but I hadn't ever imagined I'd get a personal visit. Surely a phone call or an email would have been sufficient to handle any issues that had resulted from the destruction of the furniture I'd sold to them. Donald, standing by his car, looked as crisp as he had the morning he'd spent examining the contents of my attic. Creased khakis, seersucker shirt, polished loafers. His salt-and-pepper hair and mustache were freshly trimmed, and he radiated a sort of middle-aged tan fitness. Golfer, maybe. He seemed to be having some difficulty. I opened the door, worried about the simmering sweet potatoes, which should be nearly done.
"Hey, Mr. Calloway," I called. "What are you doing way out here?"
And why didn't he approach?
"Can I come in for a second?" he asked.
"Okay," I said, and he started forward. "But I'm afraid I don't have a lot of time."
He was just a little surprised that I wasn't more cordial. I got a waft of wrongness. I dropped all my shields and looked inside his brain. He was on the porch now, and I said, "Stop right there." He looked at me with apparent surprise.
"What have you done?" I asked. "You've screwed me over somehow. You might as well tell me."
His eyes widened.
"Are you human?"
"I'm human with extras. Spill it, Mr. Calloway."
He was almost frightened, but he was becoming angry, too. That was a bad combination.
"I need that thing that was in the secret compartment."
Revelation.
"You opened it first, before you showed it to me."
It was my turn to be astonished.
"If I'd had any idea what that thing was, I'd never have told you," he said, regret weighing down his voice. "As it was, I thought it was worthless, and I thought I might as well boost my reputation for honesty."
"But you're not honest, are you?"
I glided through his thoughts, my head tilted on one side.
"You're a twisty bastard."
The wards around the house had been trying to keep him out, but like an idiot, I'd invited him in. He had the gall to be offended.
"Come on now, just trying to turn a buck and keep our business afloat in a bad economy."
He thought he could tell me this and I'd accept it? I checked him out quickly but thoroughly. I didn't think he had a gun, but he had a knife and a sheath clipped to his belt, just like many men who had to open boxes every day. It wasn't a big knife, but any knife was pretty damn frightening.
"Sookie," he continued, "I came out here tonight to do you a favor. I don't think you know that you have a valuable little item. Interest in this item is heating up, and word's getting around. You might find it a tad dangerous to keep it in your house. I'll be glad to put it in the safe at my office. I did some research on your behalf, and what you think may just be a pretty thing your grandma left in the desk is something a few people do want for their private collection."
Not only had he opened the secret compartment and glanced at the contents before he'd called me to come look, he'd at least scanned the letter. The letter my grandmother had written to me. Thank God he hadn't had a chance to read it carefully. He was completely ignorant about me. Something inside me caught fire. I was mad, really mad.
"Come in," I said calmly. "We'll talk about it."
He was surprised but relieved. I smiled at him. I turned and walked back to the kitchen. There were lots of weapons in the kitchen. Calloway followed me, his loafers making little thwacks on the boards of the floor. It would be very opportune if Jason arrived right now for his sweet potato casserole, or if Dermot came home for supper, but I wasn't going to count on their help.
"So, did you open the bag? You looked at it?" I said over my shoulder. "I don't know why Gran left me an old powder compact, but it is kind of pretty. Gran was sort of a crackpot, a sweet old lady, but real imaginative."
"So often our elderly relatives love things that don't really have much intrinsic value," the antiques dealer said. "In your case, your grandmother left you an item that is of interest only to a few specialized collectors."
"Really? What is it?"
She called it something crazy.
I was still leading the way. I smiled to myself. I was pretty sure it wasn't a very pleasant smile. He didn't hesitate.
"It's a turn-of-the-century Valentine's Day present," he said, "made out of soapstone. If you can open it, there's a little compartment for a lock of the hair of the person giving it."
"Really? I couldn't open it. You know how?"
I was sure that only the intention to use it could open the Cluvial door.
"Yes, I'm pretty sure I can open it," he said, and he believed that, but he'd never tried.
He hadn't had time that day, had had only a quick glance at the Cluvial door and at the letter. He assumed that he'd be able to open the round object because he'd never been thwarted when he tried to open similar antique items before.
"That would be real interesting," I said. "And how many people are going to bid on this old thing? How much money you think I could make?"
"At least 2 people are involved," he said. "But that's all you need to make a little profit. Maybe you'd make as much as 1,000, though I have to take my cut."
"Why should I give you any? Why shouldn't I contact them myself?"
He sat at the kitchen table, uninvited, while I went to the stove to check the sweet potatoes. They were done. All the other ingredients, butter, eggs, sugar, molasses, allspice, nutmeg, and vanilla, were arranged in a row on the counter, ready for me to measure. The oven had preheated. He was taken aback by my question, but he rallied.
"Why, you don't want to deal with these people, young lady. They're pretty rough people. You want to let me do that. So it's only fair that I get a little recompense for my trouble."
"What if I don't want to let you do that?"
I turned off the heat, but the water kept bubbling. With a slotted spoon, I scooped out the sweet potato chunks and put them in a bowl. Steam rose from them, making the kitchen even warmer, despite the air conditioner rumbling away. I was monitoring his thoughts closely, as I should have done the day he'd been here working.
"Then I'll just take it," he said.
I turned to face him. He had some mace and a knife. I heard the front door open and shut, very quietly. Calloway didn't hear it. He didn't know this house like I did.
"I won't give it up," I said flatly, my voice louder than it needed to be. "And you can't find it." "I'm an antiques dealer," he said with absolute assurance. "I'm very good at finding old things."
I didn't know if a friend had entered or another foe. Truth be told, I had little faith in the wards. The silence and stealth the newcomer employed could indicate either one. I did know I wasn't going to give up the Cluvial door, and I knew for sure I wasn't going to stand passively and let this asshole hurt me. I twisted, gripped the handle of the pot of hot water, and pivoted smoothly, flinging the water directly into Donald Calloway's face. A lot of things happened then, in very rapid succession. Calloway screamed and dropped the knife and the mace, clapping his hands to his face while water flew everywhere. The demon lawyer, Desmond Catalyades, charged into the room. He bellowed like a maddened bull when he saw Donald Calloway on the floor. The dealer was doing a little of his own bellowing. The demon leaped onto the prone dealer, gripped his head, and twisted, and all the noise stopped abruptly.
"Shepherd of Judea," I said.
I pulled out a chair and sat in it to forestall falling down on the wet floor with the body.